My name is David Thoreau, and I'm the president of the Independent Institute. I'm delighted to welcome you to our Independent Policy Forum this evening. As many of you know, the Independent Policy Forum is a regular series of lectures, seminars, and debates we hold here at our conference center in Oakland and elsewhere. Our program today is entitled Globalization and Cultural Diversity, Friends or Foes? And we're very pleased to have with us as our speaker the economist and author Tyler Cowen, who is the author of the very important new book from Princeton University Press called Creative Destruction. As many of you know, the Institute regularly sponsors events like this, and the programs are designed to feature outstanding scholars, policy experts, and authors to discuss major social and economic issues, and this evening is certainly no exception. I also want to take the opportunity to thank Vianza Winery, who generously donated the wine that we enjoyed this evening. For those of you who are new to the Institute, hopefully you picked up a packet when you registered. In it, you'll find information about the Institute's program, including our publications. There's also a flyer in there on tonight's program. And on the bottom of the first page, under Tyler's photo, you'll see information about our upcoming event, which is on June 25th, and that will feature three scholars, including our senior fellow Ivan Eland, and the topic that will be discussed is preemptive war strategy, a new U.S. empire, question mark. So the issue of globalization obviously touches on a lot of different issues. More specifically, the Independent Institute is a nonprofit public policy research institute. In addition to events like this, we sponsor and publish many books. We produce the quarterly journal, The Independent Review, and this is the current issue, which I also recommend for anyone interested in global issues. The cover article is called Why Ireland Boomed, as far as an issue of economic development and trade and so forth. You're also welcome to visit our website, independent.org. You'll find many studies and information about our program and new developments. And if you don't receive the Lighthouse, which is our weekly email newsletter, it's free, and you're certainly welcome to do so. You can actually subscribe on the homepage. One other thing I wanted to mention is that each summer we hold a series of summer seminars for students, high school students and college students. In your packet, you'll also find this brochure, which describes this summer's programs. We're holding two seminars this coming summer, which will be held the weeks of June 16th to the 20th and August 11th to the 15th. These are Monday through Friday programs held each morning. They're lively, they're highly informative. We actually have a number of students here tonight who've been to summer seminars, and you can certainly ask them their opinion of it. If you have children or know of students who could benefit from an intensive exposure to economics history and related fields, we certainly hope that you can encourage them to apply and enroll. Those who do can receive a one-hour college course credit from Holy Names College, which also co-sponsors the program with the Institute. For this evening, since 9/11, Americans have been understandably transfixed by world events, but the issue of globalization is hardly a new one. International trade and travel have been intrinsic with human affairs for millennia. But in the modern world, there's been a rapid acceleration of global interaction and exchange, and in recent years, there's developed a great deal of confusion, we believe, about the nature and impact of globalization. Not only about the impact, but what on earth globalization is. As a result, I'd like to make one distinction, sort of to set a little background for tonight's program. On the one hand, globalization might be that of the classic example of the invading army, who seizes and occupies a territory for various reasons. On the other hand, is the concept of globalization where people trade, communicate, and travel peacefully. In other words, the first is based on coercive transnational relations at the behest of, or the instigation of one party. The second is based on a mutual exchange or agreement among different people. However, today, one of the questions that's raised is, do all parties really benefit? Do they benefit in the latter case, or do some dominate others? As many have been asking, is globalization resulting in American culture taking over the world? Do countries with open trade policies risk losing their unique cultures to a diet of McDonald's, Levi's, MTV? Or does globalization simply enlarge a country's cultural menu, allowing people to choose from a wider variety? Does trade result in cultural decline, or does cultural destruction allow a high culture of a society to coexist with other high cultures and with popular culture and enable a richer array of cultures to flower? We're very pleased, as I mentioned, to have this evening as our speaker Tyler Cowen. Tyler is a professor of economics and general director of the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. He received his PhD in economics from Harvard University. He's contributed to numerous scholarly volumes in addition to the one we're featuring tonight. I'll also mention this is another one of our new books that Tyler is co-editor of, called Market Failure or Success, which we strongly recommend anyone interested in economic issues, networking, high technology issues, excuse me, and so forth. And there are copies you can examine upstairs. Tyler's other books include Public Goods and Market Failure, Explorations in the New Monetary Economics, What Price Fame, Economic Welfare, The Theory of Market Failure, Markets and the Firm, and In Praise of Commercial Culture. I guess I may have left out one or two there. But his articles have appeared in most major academic journals and elsewhere. I'm very pleased to introduce to you Tyler Cowen.
Tonight's talk is about free trade, and the main claim is that free trade is beautiful. This, I think, is a somewhat surprising claim. We're used to economists, such as Milton Friedman, telling us that free trade is efficient, that free trade increases our wealth, it brings us more goods and services. We've also had philosophers, such as Tibor McCann, who's with us here tonight, tell us that free trade and free exchange are just, moral, the only moral system. I agree with those arguments. But it's this third aspect that I wish to play up in my research. It's really been the theme of most of what I've written in the last 10 years, and that's this claim that free trade is beautiful, that most of the beauty we have in our lives, most of the art we consume, buy, enjoy, it comes from free trade, it comes from prosperity, it comes from capitalism, it is enabled, encouraged, and stimulated by having a free society. In particular tonight, I'm going to look at this issue of globalization, which I take to mean greater contacts across borders, more migration, more trade, more investment. And in my book, Creative Destruction, I ask the question, is globalization, or free trade, has it been beautiful? Or has it brought us bad fast food, bad soap operas, and a splitting headache? So that's my basic question. It goes all the way back to Plato. Plato asked, are the market economy and aesthetic quality fundamentally allies or enemies? And I think that while it's a complex story, fundamentally they are allies. I have a pretty simple model in the back of my mind, and that is take creative human beings and allow them to have more opportunities to trade with each other. My simple model suggests they're going to do some pretty wonderful things. They will manage to trade ideas. They will manage to trade styles. They will exchange technologies. Sometimes one group of people will simply serve as customers for the other group of people. So Claude Monet, the French painter, when he started painting those haystacks that you see in American museums, why do you see so many haystacks in American museums? Well, at that time, a lot of the French art buyers, they looked down on Claude Monet. They saw the haystacks and they thought they were ugly. Monet tried to market his art to the government salon in France. He was turned down. He was told he had no talent. He was rejected. He was told, try again. They told him everything possible except yes. So what Monet did, like a clever entrepreneur, is he took his haystack paintings and he found someone else who wanted to buy them. He found North Americans. So he sold them to wealthy buyers in this country. And in fact, it was American buyers who helped French Impressionism get a good bit of its start, just by supplying the money. We didn't supply inspiration, technology, ideas. We just supplied the money. So that's an example of how free trade brings beauty into our lives. I have a number of versions of the talk I'm giving tonight. The last time I gave this talk, it was about the history of classical music. So I played some pieces by Johann Sebastian Bach. Yes, perhaps the most famous German composer. But when you dissect the style of Bach, you find it's a free trade style, that it's cosmopolitan. It's synthetic. It's a mix of French influences. He wrote the French suites, Italian influences, Vivaldi. And Bach picked up on Italian music because now there was trade in musical manuscripts. There was the printing press and trade in these manuscripts. It took ideas from music from northern France, Franco-Flemish musics, musics from all around Germany, all around Europe. And in this talk, I showed that the music of Bach was again a case of free trade bringing beauty into our lives. I'm giving another version of this talk tomorrow, and that's about the history of oil painting in the Renaissance. It's kind of a slideshow. We're going to look at Leonardo da Vinci, Mona Lisa, John Van Eyck, Michelangelo. And all of those works, they really became possible because trade networks opened up again in late medieval times and the Renaissance. If you think about the Dark Ages and the fall of the Roman Empire, it's very instructive to see what happened then. People would take bronze statues, Greek bronze statues that today would sell for millions of dollars, and they would melt down these beautiful statues just to get the metal. They'd destroy the work of art to get the metal. No new bronze statues were made for centuries. They were melted down. As trade picked up, the world became wealthier. The merchant was an important figure. Businesses grew. Roads and trade networks and cities began to populate Europe once again. We found that the arts suddenly became possible. Instead of melting down statues, for the first time in a while, people were making statues again and selling them to wealthy customers. So this period that we call the Renaissance is yet another example of trade relations, capitalism, markets, prosperity, making people's lives more beautiful, more creative, more interesting. And if we look at the history of the world, I think we find as a general pattern, with very few exceptions, that when you have a time period when trade is growing and wealth is growing, that culture and the arts and beauty is growing as well. Another great era of globalization is the 19th century. When the 19th century was in progress, people said at the time, they didn't use the word globalization, but they talked about the same thing. They said, this is wiping out our culture. We're all becoming the same. Creativity is at an end. You heard this in the late 18th century. Too much trade, too much commercialization. But what is it that the 19th century brought? It brought Dickens, it brought Beethoven, it brought an outpouring of culture in many different areas that really at that time had been without precedent. And again, like the Renaissance, we see the same formula of it being driven by trade, driven by capitalistic enterprise. When we think about globalization, the most common criticism we hear is that the world is all becoming alike. And I think there is more than a grain of truth to this, but I think it's not looking at the whole picture. So in some ways, yes, the world is becoming more alike. Let's say that today, you get on a plane and you fly to Germany. If you're in Germany, today you can buy sushi in Germany. I lived in Germany in 1985 which is not so long ago. And then perhaps you could buy sushi in Berlin or Frankfurt, but it was actually pretty hard to buy sushi in Germany. Now today, it's fairly easy to buy sushi. You can't get it in a small village, but you can get it in a lot of places, and in a lot of places it's pretty good. If you're in France today, you can get sushi. If you're in Germany or in France and you want to buy reggae music, basically you can do it. So yes, in this sense, Germany and France are more alike. They both have sushi. They both have reggae music. They both have Persian carpets. So when people tell you the world is becoming more alike, yes, they are correct, but what they are leaving out is that the world is becoming more alike by becoming more commonly diverse. That is, in each of these places, you can choose from a wide variety of things. You can choose from a very diverse menu. I suggest that the critics of globalization have in mind a collectivist concept of diversity. Their idea of diversity is to think of a line, call it a border, and the people on one side of the line have things that people on the other side of the line don't have. So their idea of diversity is not having something. And if you think about it, that's a little funny, because what's so great about not having something that other people have? My idea of diversity is not to look at the collectives, but to look at the individuals and ask yourself, in Germany, in France, in the United States, how many different kinds of goods can you buy? How many different kinds of arts? How many different courses can your life go down? How many different choices does the individual face? How many different stories or fates can you construct for yourself? And that, to me, to look at the individual, the differences that are possible across individuals, that is, to me, true diversity. Not this idea that the people across the border have things that you don't have, because that's not having something. And that's not my idea of fun. My idea of fun is to have things, or if you don't have them, at least to have the choice of having them. If you look at today's world more than ever before, people are liberated from what I call the tyranny of place. The tyranny of place occurs when you grow up somewhere. Maybe it's a poor country, maybe it's a rural area, maybe it's an inner city, depends. But you grow up somewhere and you have no choice of leaving. You cannot choose another culture, you cannot choose another language, you cannot get on a plane, you cannot travel, you cannot choose your job. That's what I call the tyranny of place. Today, the world is more liberated from the tyranny of place than ever before, and it has become so liberated precisely because, coming back to our themes, of free trade, globalization, capitalistic markets, and prosperity. Now, I mentioned the last talk I gave was about classical music and Bach. And the next talk I'm giving is about history of oil painting. So I thought tonight I'd talk a little about music of the Caribbean and how the music of the Caribbean illustrates just a few of the themes I'm talking about. And keep in mind, this is only one example. And one example, even two examples, they never prove anything. But I try to show in my book that this one example is pretty general. So if you'd like to see more about the generality, there's question and answers, but also there's my book. But I think this one example is a good illustration. So take the country of Jamaica. Jamaica is obviously a small country. It has a bit more than 2 million people. In times past, it had fewer. Obviously, it's very close to the United States. To fly to Jamaica from Miami, it takes maybe an hour and 10 minutes. Not very long. And furthermore, what's the native language of Jamaica? Well, they say it's English. It's not always the English you and I would understand, but it's English. So if there were ever a classic example of American culture moving in, wiping out local culture, taking over the country, destroying diversity, you would think Jamaica and the Caribbean is really just ripe for that kind of thing to happen. And what I did in my book, Creative Destruction, this one, is look at a bunch of cases where you would think the story of cultural imperialism is true, and actually go look at the facts and see what happened. And I find in general what happens is much closer to this story of how free trade supports beauty. Now, to turn to Jamaican music, the Jamaican recording industry is pretty young. It dates to the early 1950s. Before the early 1950s, there literally was no Jamaican recording industry. So talk about having a disadvantage or having an infant industry. The first Jamaican recording studio, there was a guy who sold refrigerators in downtown Kingston. And in his shop, he just started recording musical artists and cutting discs. That was 1951, the guy named Stanley Mata. But anyway, I'd like to talk about how reggae music came about. And this will illustrate some of our themes that free trade brings beauty, and also a theme that all culture, it's not national culture or even regional culture, it's all global culture, it's all synthetic. It's all a mix of influences. So let me first play you a bit of a musical cut, just a short bit of it, to give you some idea of what Jamaican traditional music sounded like. Now, there were several traditional Jamaican musics. They drew heavily from, as you would expect, music of Africa. They also drew from European dance music, the quadrille in particular, and they drew pretty heavily from British sea shanties, and also from calypso, from Trinidad. Those were some of the musics that were percolating in Jamaica in the 40s and 50s. But I'll play you just one of the dance musics, and when you listen to this, just keep the rhythm in your mind, because we're going to come back to that rhythm and see how it evolved. Hear the horn? Hear how everything's on the upbeat and the offbeat? It's a kind of country music. People would just play it for fun. That was Jamaican music a while ago. And what happens in the 1950s, basically, is that American music comes along, and it's integrated into the stew of African influences, Jamaican influences, British influences. So people in Jamaica were able to get American radio stations from New Orleans, which was not so far away. Some Jamaicans went to work in the United States. In other cases, Jamaican DJs would use sound systems and play American rhythm and blues. So let me play you an American cut or two. This is the kind of thing the Jamaicans were listening to. Bear with me for a second while I change CDs. You like that song? Well, the Jamaicans did too. They loved it. Play you just another bit of one.
Good night, sweetheart, well, it's time to go. Good night, sweetheart, well, it's time to go. I hate to leave you, but I really must say, oh, good night, sweetheart, good night.
That's a style, as you know, it's called doo-wop. It was big in this country. It also had a huge influence in South Africa, many parts of the world. But now let's hear what the Jamaicans did. They were just inspired. And keep in mind that original rhythm you heard, the one of the horns, the first cut. Thank you. Do you like that one too? Where's that from? It's from Jamaica. And you can hear it. They took doo-wop, but put it to their own rhythms, and came up with a new musical form, which later was called ska. And ska was really the beginnings of what we call reggae. It was a kind of early rhythm and blues. And you'll find some of the early Jamaican styles, they also drew on rhythm and blues more directly. I'll play you another cut briefly. This is more bluesy. And that's free trade. You hear that all these musical forms are an exchange of ideas. Just as doo-wop was drawn upon other styles, including gospel music, African music, European music, Jamaican music incorporated American ideas, and it became this blend. Keep in mind, Jamaican music suddenly became very popular. All kinds of record labels sprung up. There were a lot of Jamaican entrepreneurs who made a good deal of money. Artists frequently didn't get rich, but they earned more than they would have earned otherwise. And Jamaican music started becoming something. The next thing that happens in Jamaican music is evolution towards the style we know as reggae. And there were yet further changes. So think about those cuts. Again, everything's on the upbeat and the offbeat. And what are the tempos like? They're pretty fast, pretty propulsive. All ska was propulsive. Reggae comes about when they start slowing down that beat and playing around with it. So I'm going to play you a cut or two, the transition from ska to reggae, which now is taking place in the late 1960s. But let me note also, reggae music has always, from the beginning, had a history in the United Kingdom as well, and in London, and it really co-evolved in Jamaica and Great Britain at the same time. So reggae isn't even strictly only a Jamaican music. Again, it's an international cosmopolitan art form. Here's a Jamaican cut that drew from popular culture. Now, the James Bond movies were a big hit all around the world, and there was one Jamaican artist named Desmond Dekker who was inspired by the Bond movies, and another movie he liked was called Ocean's 11, which was remade recently with George Clooney, but of course he saw the earlier version, I think with Frank Sinatra and the so-called Rat Pack, and he decided to cut a song where he would narrate a story that was about James Bond and Ocean's 11, somehow in the same universe. And he took ska and he started slowing down and stretching out that beat. Again, a very entrepreneurial, innovative activity. Slower. Oh, 07. Understand all the lyrics either. So if you don't think there's a problem with your English. Most Jamaicans, it's like there's at least two kinds of English they speak, how they speak to each other and how they'll speak, say, to me. And that song, I think, is somewhere in between. But Desmond Dekker, he started to become a star in Jamaica, but he, along with a lot of other Jamaican musicians, they faced an obvious problem. And that problem was that there's only 2 million plus Jamaicans, and most of them are pretty poor, and it was hard for them to support themselves. So So what they started to do was to look to outside markets. And in about the late 60s, early 70s, it became the case that they were selling more reggae to people in the United States and United Kingdom than in Jamaica. And ever since then, reggae really has existed, the most part, by selling to people in other countries, just like Claude Monet sold his haystacks to American buyers. Let me play you one cut. It was the first crossover cut, the first reggae album, if you'd even call it reggae, to sell a million copies. And this was a song called My Lollipop. You probably know it. That was My Boy Lollipop. And reggae music became even more established on the international scene. There was a song by Desmond Dekker called Israelites, which I think was the first reggae song ever to hit number one on the American and UK pop charts. And this is the kind of entry that led to Bob Marley becoming an international superstar. Let me play you this, because now you'll see the reggae style full-blown. But you'll also see just how synthetic reggae music is. Two other spiritual influences. One is from Christianity and Judaism. The song is called The Israelites, which of course is Middle East. But also it's about the Rastafarian religion, which inspired a lot of reggae music. And that came from Ethiopia, East Africa. And this now is the full reggae sound, what you're going to get.
Get up in the morning, slaving for breakfast, so that every mouth can be fed. Me Israelite. Get up in the morning, slaving for breakfast, so that every mouth can be fed. Me Israelite. On my feet, get back up and I'm leaving. Darling, she said, I was yours to be seen.
That was a huge hit. I think that it's 1968. Now I bet you think I'm going to play some Bob Marley for you, but I'm not. Because you've all heard Bob Marley. Oh. But I'll point out something interesting about Bob Marley. In the middle of his musical career, he ran out of money. So how did he continue his musical career? He came to the United States, and for about 2 years, he worked for General Motors on the assembly line and saved up his money. It's in the late 60s, and then he went back to Jamaica to resume his musical career. So can you imagine that? You're some guy, you're working in Detroit, you're putting together Chevys, and next to you on the assembly line is Bob Marley? But I think the point is that a commercial society has many aspects that are not directly creative, like the assembly line for General Motors, but nonetheless in indirect ways, by giving people more choice, more wealth, more opportunity, they will stimulate creative production. Now I'd like to go back to one of our original questions and ask, well, this relationship between Jamaica and the United States and the United Kingdom, whose culture pushed out whose? Which culture dominated? Which was more influential? Did Jamaican culture somehow disappear? Was it swamped by American culture? I think the answer is no. And I think just as American music has influenced Jamaican music, we see Jamaican music has had really a profound impact on American and British music. And let me play you just an example or two, which you may recognize. He's a guy who loves to borrow music from other places. In 1971, he heard reggae and he went to Kingston to record the song with Jamaican musicians.
I could hear it right away.
Hear the rhythm? Really, a blend of that reggae rhythm with a kind of gospel and some doo-wop thrown in, and of course that's Paul Simon. That was right after he split up with Art Garfunkel, and he wanted to go his own way, so he went to Kingston, and that song was a huge hit in the U.S. market, the U.K. market. Another musician who was very influenced by reggae, someone you'll also know, I'll play you another cut. What's that? Hear the rhythm? Some ska from reggae? Everything on the offbeat? Loping the whole time, the rhythm. That's Paul and Linda McCartney, of course. 1974, drawn directly from reggae. Paul's first reggae song actually was Obladi Oblada from the White Album. Again, very much a reggae beat. So there's been a kind of cultural imperialism where Jamaica has colonized the United States. The United Kingdom. Play you one other example. This is a song I think most of you will know. The song I grew up with. I didn't understand it at the time. It made no sense to me when I first heard it as a 16-year-old. Complete reggae, right? It's Blondie. For doo-wop, it's doo-wop filtered through Jamaica, coming back round to Deborah Harry. Now, when I first heard that, I enjoyed it, but I had no idea about this, what I'm about to play you, and you probably don't know it either.
No.
Guesses as to which one came first. That's the Paragons from Jamaica. And of course, Deborah Harriet Blondie, she did a direct copy of the song. It's also not so well known that rap music which some of you may regard as a curse, but I like some of it. Rap music actually came from Jamaica, and it's not native to the United States. There's a Jamaican style called dance hall, where there'd be a rhythm going, and over the rhythm, the DJ would start speaking, what we now call rapping. And some of these DJs wanted to find new markets. They came to the Bronx and played parties in New York City. People like Kool Herc. And they started rapping over records, and it became rap. But the very first rappers were Jamaican DJs, and they were importing the style from Jamaica. And that's, again, an example of culture going back and forth. We find now there's rap music in Mexico and France. There's reggae in Africa. There's doo-wop and forms of doo-wop all over. And we come back to some of these core truths, that all culture is synthetic, is cosmopolitan, is rooted in trade, that trade brings beauty. Keep in mind, trade brings some ugliness too. If you think about Paris or Hong Kong, they're maybe the world's two centers for haute cuisine. They're also the two cities in the world with the busiest Pizza Hut outlets. So when trade brings you more choice, you're not going to like all of that choice. Just as some of you don't like rap music. But the point is that we're in a society where you're not subject to the tyranny of place. No one feels, well, I was born into a culture that only has rap music. There's no other kind of music I can buy or listen to. I recently, for my car, I bought satellite radio. It's a marvel. I recommend it if you don't know it. For $10 a month, I get 100 stations. They're almost completely commercial-free. There's a whole station for reggae, a whole station for Latin jazz, a whole station for the music of the 40s. 100 stations, every kind of music you can think of, with good DJs, for $10 a month. It's music from the internet, music from book and record superstores, really a blinding array of music, so much to make you dizzy. There's jazz, there's country, there's gospel, there's folk, there's blues, there's classical, there's romantic music, there's opera, there's rap, there's techno, there's raga. You could go on and on and on. And the choices of music we have today are just remarkable, and this has all come about because of modern technology, markets, and free trade. So I'd just like to close this talk by saying, next time you look at your favorite work of art, or hear your favorite song, or put on your favorite symphony, don't just think of the art. Think of the market. Think of free trade. Thank you all for coming.